My name is Lynn Crow. I'm a teaching elder in the PCA, Philadelphia Presbytery. And I'm happy to be back at the seminary. Because I went here before the building was here. So I know I don't look that old. But I came here to take some courses with Dr. Vantil. And so it's really a joy to be standing teaching in the building named after one of the patron saints. But I'm glad you're here. I want to go through some material with you. And as people come in, I want to interrupt myself and make sure they get it. It's okay. Prisons are overcrowded, but we need more people that are going to take them seriously. Our dialogue, which you see at the bottom of this little sheet, that's the outline I want to follow up with you. I want to make some introductory comments about the relationship that the navigators have to prison, because I'm on the navigator staff. Even though I am a PCA teaching owner, I am full-time now with navigators. I finished with them in September of 2004 after a long trail of ministry here in Philadelphia. God drew me into the work of the prisons in an unusual way. I'll mention that really in the session. But I felt that of all the organizations I knew, that I knew well, I thought the Navigators had a DNA, had a philosophy of ministry that really touched a deep need in prisons. And they're not known for having prison ministry, Navigators. They're known for being in the military, right? And for being on college campuses. Now they're being better known for doing church discipleship training and things like that. But the NAS have been pretty serious about prison for the last 5 or 10 years. They've been in partnership with Prison Fellowship. And I'm going to show you some materials here in the first few minutes that have come out of that partnership. The partnership really connects the NAS to Prison Fellowship in terms of producing material. How many of you know anything about the Navigators? You know when they were started?
Do I know when it started?
Yeah.
Times of World War II with Dawson Trotman.
Exactly right. Yeah. It was back prior to the war.
I think of it the Navy out in San Diego.
Right. That's the name, Navigators, yeah. And just in God's providence, he used, on the flip side of that great war, and he dispersed this ministry all over the world. So NAVs are now in over 100 countries. There's over 4,000 staff scattered around the world. And I think what God's been doing with our organization, since I'm a newcomer to it, I kind of have a way of looking at it, maybe a little different than people that have been with it all their life. But I think God has begun to turn the Navigators toward the city. And I think the impulse for that is coming back from overseas. As an international body, an international fellowship and ministry, about 40% of the senior leadership and navigators are in other countries. They're not here in North America. And the impulse and stimulus for taking on the issues of poverty and ministering the gospel to the poor are flowing back from other parts of the world. And navigators have come to the realization, like a lot of ministries have, is that that population, that flow of immigration, that flow of issues, has in fact arrived in American cities and been with us for a long time. And if you want to really touch this country, you got to touch the city. If you want to touch the city for real, then you got to work with people that are the majority in our cities, who are marginalized economically, going to be in poverty, and a huge percentage of those folks are in prison. So navigators will take the prison seriously. Even though we don't have a long history of prison ministry, we don't have a great tradition of prison ministry with 1,000 people, we have a significant relationship with prison ministry. By pouring in the learning and the understanding of how to know Christ, how to understand the Bible, how to disciple somebody, how to walk with people until they're going to get it, that whole navigator DNA is internal. And in my judgment, when I looked at the situation in Philadelphia, I thought that was a critical missing ingredient in prison ministry. We do a lot of evangelism, but hardly any discipleship. And virtually no mentoring. So to me, that was kind of a marriage made in heaven. I just felt called to participate in the Philadelphia prison system with something that would contribute, not just to the few individual inmates that I can meet and minister to, but for the whole church. And I think that is make a great contribution. And not the only organization, obviously, that's involved in prison. NADs are involved in prison strategically. There's a special kind of ingredient that's thrown into prisons because of our organization's participation. And I represent some of that in Philadelphia. Part of the story I will tell you, and I want to try to encourage you. But people are just getting in. I have a very small handout. I got a lot of this stuff in here now. David said, always make more contacts. I was loving the
I was a college professor for many, many years.
Okay. Just take a couple back.
Yeah, just, yeah, thanks.
So I'm very comfortable in the classroom. They want to record this.
So I have to kind of wander back and forth and stay somewhere close to this mic so they can hear me. But you're the most important people here. And I want to be sure that as we go forward, if I say something that you need to have clarified, stop me. I know there's a question and answer session at the end of the day, and I was informed by Manny Hackman that I should tell all of you to write your questions down and there'll be the opportunity for the panel. Did you get that message already?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So I've fulfilled my obligation to Manny. We're old friends from way back. I was on the pastoral staff at 10th for about 7 years. Manny was a part of 10th at the time. So we have an old relationship there. All right. Let me take on section one here, the Navigator's contribution. I mentioned materials because I think I want you to know if you're involved in prison ministry or you're going to get involved in prison ministry, I want you to know what we have that you can use. And this is all free. It's not, it's on the web, it's available, it's downloadable and printable. It's one of the great things I like about their approach to prison ministry. They're not trying to sell products to people. I have some other things attached to this top sheet and just put some back. And I'll be illustrating some of our ministry in the city. But I want to deal with this top sheet first, which is just a list of prison-related materials that NASA produced.
Is there a Pittsburgh Navigator prison ministry?
A what?
Pittsburgh version.
Maybe. I don't know who it would be. But I just don't, because I'm so new, I don't know all the Navigator people. The fellow whose name is on the top of this sheet, Chuck Broughton. Chuck is the author of a very well-known Navigator series called Design for Discipleship. I don't know if you've ever seen it or used it. There's a series of books and booklets that walk people through the development of Christian life. And Chuck has adapted that kind of study methodology to prison ministry, and it's kind of tested and been well used. But what Chuck has done, because he's become sensitized to and now educated in issues related to literacy, and he has written material for the use of the prisons that is written at about a fourth grade reading level. He uses verses from the Bible that have been, you know, where the Bible's been translated with a limited vocabulary, so that people that don't have good reading skills can still do it. He's also part of the orality movement. I don't know if you know what's going on there. People that can't read at all, how do you communicate the gospel to these folks?
And there's a number of mission organizations around the world who are wrestling with that, because even though the Bible's been translated, you know, X number of times, there's so many little languages around the world, there's still, and I just got the International Bulletin of Missionary Research the day before yesterday, and I looked at their annual survey sheet. There's more languages that have not yet got the Bible than the ones that do. After all the years of Summer Institute of Linguistics and Wycliffe Translates, all of the major lingua franca of the world have the Bible. But there's all these little, you know, groups. And so some of those mission agencies that are in that arena are trying to figure out, well, how do we communicate the story of the Bible to people that don't yet know how to read? Their language hasn't even, you know, put into writing, but we can still get the gospel story to them, because we now have technologies that are different than print, right?
Well, Chuck got involved with this group, and some other people at Navigators have been involved with them, and he began to realize that we got a lot of guys in prison who can't read. And so they produced an amazing little tool that's come out of that movement. It's been used overseas, but he started to apply it to prison. This is a little audio scroller. It's not a recording device. It's got a little chip in here, which has the whole Bible story on it. And it's in Spanish, as well as English. It's in a hip-hop version, for those that don't know standard English, right? And it's a wonderful tool.
How much does it cost?
I honestly don't know. What I have in my hand is a sample or early version. But in places overseas, they're just amazing stories of these little things being given to folks kind of in the bush environments where you don't need electricity for it because it's got a solar powered battery in the back. And it's got a little thing on here, people hanging around their neck, and they're working in the field and they play this thing, and they basically can hear the story of the Bible unfold just, you know, even though it can't read. And so Chuck gave us team and asked me if we would field test it in Philadelphia prisons with guys that, you know, would help us figure out, you know, how we're doing with it. And he took it to Angola down in Louisiana. I don't know if you've ever heard of that prison. It's one of America's most notorious prisons.
Horrible place. But he spent a week in Angola with these and some other things, and apparently had a big impact. I mention that because I want you to see that Navigators, this old, you know, collegiate military ministry, is really taking that and trying to apply it to this arena. And this material is good. It looks like it's very simplistic, but it's been carefully thought through. Graphics related to it, so that people that are struggling with the reading, they can catch from the graphics what the point is. And I've discovered, you know, educator that I am. I mean, imagine, I spent 28 years teaching college students. So I ought to be able to teach anybody, right? Well, how do I teach a guy who can't read? I mean, I was out of my depth, let me tell you. Way out of my depth. So I'm grateful for this material, because what I've done is, I mean, I went to seminary, right? I became ordained. I spent several years serving in the church. I know how to write a sermon. Okay, I know how to do inductive Bible study, and, you know, so I can do my own stuff, right? But in the context of everything else going on in prison, to have a simple, straightforward, well-laid-out curriculum that's easily understood and is a tool that's easy to reproduce and use is a wonderful gift. It really is. So I spend my time in preparation, really, in relating to the men in the situation, finding other stuff to bring in and connect to their world, rather than spend all my time trying to reread the Bible to create a prison, you know, sermon. You hear what I'm saying? It's a wonderful tool. So if you take that sheet, I'm really not wasting time. I think this is an important part of what I want to communicate to you. This player coaches now that you see on the sheet, that's the thing that was created with Prison Fellowship. I don't remember how many years ago it was, but not too long. Prison Fellowship convened a meeting in Washington at their headquarters
25 of the major evangelical paramilitary groups. Ability and Evangelist Association, Campus Crusade, InterVarsity, Walk Through Bible, there's a whole gang of them. Navigators was one of this group. And President Fellowship made the pitch that if we all work together and everybody uses the skill and experience and tools that they have developed, we could reach every prison in this country in the next 5 years. And that was the appeal. Well, it's taken them more than 5 years, but they're still active. It was a wonderful vision. All the federal and state prisons in the country within 10 years.
They're going after prisons, not just not jails?
That's exactly right. That's a very perceptive question. Now I'm going to talk about it. Because the city prisons are jails, the county jails. They're not part of it. But still, that's a massive population of people. Wonderful campaign. So they called it Operation Starting Line, and they raised a lot of money. And you know, Chuck Colson knows how to raise money. If he doesn't know anything else, he knows how to raise money. And they had this massive campaign. Well, Navigators wrote the material for it. And that's what's right there in that document. This player coach's training manual here, it has three major sections. The first section is introductory. How do you train somebody to become effective in prison ministry? How to mentor somebody, how to share your faith, how to organize and conduct Bible study, teaching, and training inside a prison. The middle portion is a set of Bible studies, and then the third section is an appendix with all kinds of material about prison, about the population, and information that's useful and helpful. But the heart of this thing is these Bible studies in the middle. It's a series of 20 Bible studies that are set up as steps, you know, step one, step two, step three. And, if you divide up the Christian life into 20 steps, right? You can get pretty far. Obviously, step one is
evangelism. Evangelism, knowing Christ.
Absolutely right. If step one is really a relationship with Jesus, you're not going to go anywhere in a Christian life without a relationship to Christ. So you start there. But then every week, or however you use these things, there's another step. And it takes a person through all of the essential disciplines of Christian maturity. Learning how to pray. Learning how to read and study the Bible. Understanding issues related to the Holy Spirit. All these different things are laid out in a series of steps. And what I love about it, it's also in Spanish. It's also in Russian, if you happen to. NAVS have a big partnership with ministries in Russia. But we have, in Philadelphia, we have an increasing number of Russian immigrants, some of whom are showing up in the jail. But the real heart of it is these Bible studies, and they're printed in a way that's really easy to use. It's a two-page little thing, just like what you have in your hand that I passed out, that little first sheet. Okay? What you do is you print it out or copy it on one side, and flip it and recopy it. And then I take out my little X-Acto cutter and I whack them in half, and then you have a complete little Bible study sheet that a guy can fold up and stick in his pocket in his prison uniform. And it's inexpensive, you save paper, and it's easy to do.
So is this useful? Like, let's say if you're doing a weekly Bible study in the prison, that you can download this stuff, and print them out in your own printer, and then how do you handle people that, you know, people that come onto prison or people that leave, people that are at different levels.
Right.
It's not like you have the same group of people.
It's not like a college course. Everybody signs up, lesson one, and they stay with you in lesson one. So we're constantly dealing with that kind of turnover, especially in the city jail. So when I'm teaching, I always take people every week. I take people back to step one. And then we work into wherever we are for that particular day. Sometimes I'll go to the effort of reproducing a set of all these lessons for guys that are very serious and want to go back and do them all on their own. But I'm only illustrating for you what a usable tool it is, how inexpensive it is, and there isn't any cost to buy it. There's no franchising of the copyright and all that kind of stuff.
I'll save you a ton of money. I'm currently in jail, Allegheny Jail, and okay. I like E.E.'s Partners in Discipleship booklet, and I just bought another big box of those.
Okay.
I have a couple leaders in the pod. Why equip them? You know, we do some systematic study and some ABC study each week. And then whenever new guys get on the pod, then I have some of the guys who've been there for a while, get the other guys up to speed.
But
this will be a lot cheaper if I just print out the unit.
Yeah, we'll see this. This loose leaf notebook that I just held up, I mean, that's how I did it. I just took it right off the website, printed it out. Now, I printed it on three-ring binder paper so that I'd have a hard copy of it. But that's working. The little color cover is also on there if you want to print that out as a separate page. For people that run Nav Press, I mean, this is like falling out of bed. You know, they can produce this kind of stuff without even thinking. So all that technology is available at your fingertips. Anybody in the world who knows English or Spanish or Russian, at least now, I think that's a winner. And I'm really kind of proud to share that with you because I think this organization has the right mindset. Because dealing with this population of people, the last thing in the world you need is a pile-on resource cost for doing ministry. There is real cost, but it's at the other end. Okay? But there is real cost, and I'm not saying that it's easy, but this resource is wonderful. The second one, life issues. Everybody talks about the need for practical mentorship of people who have been through traumatic, you know, life experience, and their life is kind of dysfunctional for whatever reason or in whatever way. Well, this set of life issues is the same thing. You can just take it right off the web and print it out. You can print the whole thing. You can print it out lesson by lesson, which is what I do, because for various reasons, sometimes you print more than others. But let me just run down the contents of this thing. The opening lesson is knowing God's will. That's a lesson that a lot of mature Christians still struggle with. How do you know God's, you know, working in your life? And how do you wrestle with that? And then a section on self-worth. Many of these people have a very negative self-image. They've been told all their life that they're not very, you know, and part of their life is reacting to that. How do you understand God's perspective on your value as a person? Then dealing with sin. It may be a little bit easier for people to acknowledge their sin when they're in prison, but hey, we have all, I mean, come short of the glory of God. We're all recovering from something. Some of us have been caught, some have not. I mean, these guys inside are very conscious of that, I'll tell you. They don't need anybody to tell you that, or to tell them that, you know. Even our mayor, when he comes into prison every New Year's, you know, John Street's been going in here every year, New Year's Day, for a big visit. Every year he says it, you know. He says, well, this is sort of an accident of history that you're there and, you know, some of us are not, you know. And they all kind of laugh at that, but that's the truth.
80% of American adults admit that if they'd been caught at some point in their lives, they would have spent some time in jail or prison. They've done something in their lifetime that was worthy of spending.
81%. Yeah, that's an interesting statistic. Well, dealing with guilt. It's on this sheet. There is a Bible study on shame that I don't think it's on here, but that's also there on the prison page, the Navigator webpage. A Bible study on shame, guilt and shame. The difference between guilt and shame is real. And it's confused for people that have been, you know, convicted of something and have been ostracized with a kind of a scarlet letter on their forehead. So it's a very interesting topic to take people into dealing with issues of, you know, of guilt. And God is taking care of that. You may be terribly ashamed of that, but you've got to get to the place where you can trust God's word, that he will not remember, you know. He will cast your sin as far as the east is from the west. For an inmate, that's very hard to believe. Because even the guards every day treat them like, you know, they're still in the middle of, you know. So it's really hard. And these are, they're not life issues in the sense of, let me teach you how to be a carpenter, but they're life issues in terms of, let me teach you how to understand yourself and to deal with the changes that are going on for you and to prepare for how you really need to live maturely on the outside. Issue of trying to be perfect. You know, once somebody becomes a Christian, if they're a young believer and they don't have much experience of the church, when they begin to fall down and trip, you know, and they get frustrated, oh my goodness. I thought I was, you know, last week I made this great commitment to Jesus. And what happened to me? You know. So it's wonderful for them to really listen to the Apostle Paul. He says, you know, who will deliver me from this body of death? You know, I can't do the things I commit to, or I do the things I wish I didn't. So it's a level of developing emotional and spiritual maturity for people. Anger. The suppressed anger in jail is unbelievable. It's like flood stage. It doesn't take much of anything to get it out. Some guy bumps a guy in the hallway, you know. And the guards feed on that too. A very high level of visible anger. It's not that it's such a violent place. When you're inside the prison, it's a very safe environment, especially compared to walking down the street downtown with a gold necklace in your hand. But the level of hostility, barely suppressed hostility, is very real. Dealing with regret, things that could have been, you know, boy, if I just hadn't done, you know, then the family wouldn't have been abandoning me, or I would be with my kids, or allowing people to get into the Bible and dealing with these hurtful realities of their life is very significant. And this is very helpful material for you. Dealing with sex, money, stress. What a stressful environment prison is. Dealing with suffering. If an inmate becomes a Christian or has already been a believer and they try to stand up, you know, they walk down a corridor with their Bible in their hand heading for the chapel. You don't think that takes some guts. There's a lot of violence in the prison related to religious identity. And I don't want to throw brick brats at anybody, but I know the Philadelphia prison, there's a lot of conflict between the different religious communities. That's very real. And guys have suffered a lot, especially when they get isolated by a group. The last topic in here is love. It may seem like an odd, direct subject to talk about, but for people who have been so hurt and have shut down, to figure out how to begin to get out of that and begin to understand God's love and what it means to be able to love and express God's love through you to other people, that's a huge challenge. But when inmates get that, and they experience that with other inmates in a context, it's exciting. It is really, truly exciting. And I've seen tremendous leadership emerge in the prison. But men have figured out that they need to be men of character, they need to be men of courage, they need to be men of love. They need to be able to express love. The desire to get back outside of the community and reconnect with spouses or children is very tangible.
So I encourage you, if you're at all involved in prison ministry or you know somebody who is, take them to that website and encourage them to look at this material and use it. I use it all the time. And it's applicable to 1,000 different things. You know, we pass out these little things and we attach something else to it. And we bring in guest speakers all the time. We add other things to this little basic curriculum. But it's a way to guide yourself to make sure that you really are covering important things in Christian discipleship. And Navigators has some great traditional tools. I don't know if you've ever seen the Navigator wheel.
My husband's in the Coast Guard.
Okay.
So
that's a simple tool, but it encompasses all the characteristics and aspects of Christian, a balanced Christian life. Another simple illustration is the hand illustration of the Bible. Have you ever seen that one? A way to underscore the importance of memorizing and meditating on the Bible. You know, if you hear the scripture read, you can remember maybe a little bit. If you read it maybe remember a little, but if you memorize passages of the Bible, then it's something you can grip with. But if you really study, you can hang on to a whole lot more. But if you meditate on the Bible, you can really grab it, and it becomes part of you. So we use that little hand illustration, and we use scripture texts, you know, about the Bible itself. Little tools like that are part of this material helps people get a grip on just the basic disciplines of spiritual growth. Nothing fancy, but again, it's written for the context of the prison, and there's illustrations in it that help, you know, make it real. There's also, the NAS has helped produce this free on the inside Bible. These are not International Bible Society sells these. But what the Navigators have done is they've produced some of this Bible study material I've been talking about. And here's a short version of the same material. But what the Bible Society did was they took the Bible study and put it right in between Malachi and Matthew, so it's right in the Bible. So if you've got somebody who's really serious and they want to study on their own, they can go right through that Bible study. You can introduce them to it, but it's something they can take back to themselves. And this is still good illustrations from prison. There are prison testimonies and stories. So it's another great resource for prison ministry
that's come out of this Navigator participation partnership. Okay. Let me bring you to Philadelphia and what has been happening in our city. Before I do, I'm sorry, I skipped my own outline. I want you to open your Bible if you have one. If you don't, I'll take you through it so generically that you won't feel lost. What is the passage in the Bible that articulates Jesus' own mission statement? You've all heard people preach on that, right? Huh? Yeah, Luke chapter 4. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. To do what?
Preach the good news to the poor. To open the eyes of the blind, release the captive, bind up the brokenhearted. All right, when Jesus stood up in the synagogue and took that scroll, what was he reading from? Isaiah? Yes. Yes, Isaiah 61. You should connect those if you haven't already. They should become part of your, at least I think, if you're at all involved in compassionate ministry, diaconal ministry, ministry in the city, they should become, you know, they should be in a family of those. Because when Jesus stands up and he says it, the church through the centuries has sort of defined its fundamental roles around that statement. So lots of churches have prison ministry because, well, Jesus said, go visit the prisoners. Or, you know, when he separates the sheep and the goats, you know, well, you did or didn't come to see me in prison. Right? See me in prison. Not just you didn't go see them, and you didn't come see me. And the church has felt that viscerally through the centuries. And so the church has felt a responsibility. Prison ministry is a fundamental part of the Christian work ethic. All right? But the reason I'm asking you to think about Isaiah 61 is that there's something in there that's not in the New Testament. Well, at least it's not quoted, repeated in the statement of the Gospels.
To set the captives at liberty or to set them free.
Yeah, turn to Isaiah 61 if you have the Bible. There's one little word in there that, for me, revolutionized how I understand not only this passage, but the entire mission that Jesus has to support. One little word in there. And I didn't see it until I was, I don't even know how to tell you how old I was, but then, so I certainly didn't see it in seminary. Because when I was in seminary, I had no experience. I had no life experience. Like a lot of young seminary students, I went to college, you know, living in the dorms and getting summer jobs, and, you know, and came to seminary, and everybody else is a student, you know, kind of deep into the Greek, and, you know. I had no life experience at all. Right? It's not a criticism of seminary. They're much more open to older students now, and they're better off for it. But when I got a little bit of life experience, and particularly here in the city of Philadelphia, and became, joined the pastoral staff of the church, and actually began to, you know, get involved with people at a different level, then I saw something in this passage that I've never seen before, ever. And I shared it with one of my bishop friends here. If you can believe this, bishop of a huge church here in Philadelphia, and he had never seen it. So I didn't feel so bad, okay? Well, Isaiah 61, Jesus is quoting the first part of that chapter. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. And just look at these words. The poor, the brokenhearted, I'm going to read the NIV. The poor, the brokenhearted, the captives, release for the prisoners. Comfort those who mourn, provide for those who grieve. That's a great diaconal ministry text. It's a great text for a conference like this. But what turned this passage upside down for me is when you read down through verse 3, get to the latter part of verse 3, there's a pronoun in there that changes everything. You see it? Anybody have it in front of you? It's the word that. See, I've been called to preach the good news to the poor, to the captive, to the ones who grieve. But now, this is what Isaiah says. I'm certain that Jesus is reflecting that in his whole ministry. Although it's not quoted in the New Testament, but I'm certain. Because he says, they will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his glory. They will restore the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. Think of North Philly. They will renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations. Do you hear that? I mean, the message is, what's going to happen is, as the good news is preached to the poor, they are going to become the display of God's glory. Okay? So for me, inside the Philadelphia jails, you know, when I'm ministering with these guys all in the blue shirts, they are going to be the oaks of righteousness. They are going to rebuild the city, not me. They know streets, places, people that I'll never meet, or nor could ever reach, okay? An old white guy, you know? But I can help them see it, okay? I can help walk with them to catch the spirit and see what God has called him to do. All right? So for me, prison ministry is not just about kind of reaching out to downtrodden people, kind of help them up, you know, all the things I can do for them. No, sir. What's happening in prison is God is calling a whole new generation of leaders to the inner city who have had, you know, life experience that has prepared them to touch the hearts of people that have been completely marginalized by the white evangelical church. I mean, I was just going to talk, I mean, this is real.
How many people, you know, living in Southwest Philadelphia are ever going to connect to somebody who came out of Colorado Springs or Wheaton, Illinois? But some guy that's been a drug dealer down the block who comes back home, a new person, who's now honest, transparent, hardworking, cares for his children, reunited with his wife, takes care of her mother. Now that person is displaying the glory of God for the kids in that neighborhood. That's the picture I have of prison ministry. You see, I think God is preparing a whole new generation to touch the inner city. And here are the statistics that got my attention. When I started getting involved with prisons, it was in a different arena. I was involved with the Leadership Foundation, and I was asked to serve by the mayor's faith-based task force. And I served by the prison committee. That's where I got a chance to see the system. I didn't kind of go into prison as a prison volunteer, you know, doing prison ministry. I had a chance to sit there looking at the system and all these politicians and the people running the system. And they were wrestling with the failure of the system. Because they know this recidivism rates are so high. You have 60 to 70% of all convicted inmates are back in prison within 3 years after they served their time. I mean, if you had a failure rate like that in your work, you couldn't keep your job. You know? They would throw you out of your church if you're a pastor. If, you know, two-thirds of the time your sermons don't make sense. But here in this system, because it's a publicly, you know, funded system, and it's all they have, and so, I mean, they're required to, you know, handle these people, but they're failing miserably, and they know it. And as they've analyzed it and wrestled with how can we be better, what can we change, what should we do? In the midst of all that, I discovered that the daily client load for the probation department downtown, this is their daily caseload, is 53,000 people. That's how many people are currently under probation, parole arrangements at a Hill and Arch Street. 53,000. That's the daily count. I mean, some come off and some come on, you know, but that's roughly the rotating number. Well, I began to really think about that.
Per day?
That's the daily count. Yeah.
That's a quarter of a million people a week.
No, no, no. What I mean is, on any given day, that's the volume of clients.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Now, they'll be on that client list, you know, for 2 years maybe, if they're on, you know, parole arrangement or something.
But that's, I mean, that's a city.
Yeah.
That's an entire city.
When you said a quarter million, what I got to think about was, all right, there's inmate, you know, Joe Hill. He's got three kids. Got a mother, grandmother. He's got aunts and uncles. So you have a client, but you've got this family network around him that have regular monthly contact with the probation department downtown. So they've been through the written system. And that's at least a quarter of a million people. So if you want to understand inner city Philadelphia, you've got to see that. And you've got to realize that there are this many people that know what it's like to get on the bus and go down and get off and throw it hard to stand in line around the corner and, you know, and wait your turn to go through the metal detector and get upstairs to see your parole officer. Now, for many people, you know, in a typical white evangelical church, that's, you know, it's not part of their reality. But in the city, it's their reality. There's not a church in the city where the pastor doesn't know that, you know, people in the congregation are going through that anyway. They got members there, they got, you know.
They got
children.
The pastor has family members.
Yeah, this is our community. Okay. This is our family.
A white evangelical church would touch that if they started doing angel tree. Because oftentimes they do that.
Yeah.
And we started to try to understand the prison stuff because we did the angel tree. And then we went, okay, if we're really going to impact them.
That's a way to connect, and it's an important way. So any personal connection to be able to see that reality is really helpful.
Well, this text from Isaiah 61 just inspired me. It drives the passion in my heart. My son came, I was talking to a bunch of pastors. He came to this meeting with me. Now he's 34 now, I guess, has three children. And he said to me, "Dad," he said, "it's really good to see your passion in you at 66 years." And that's true. It's really true. I was never so passionate about being a teacher. And frankly, I wasn't quite so passionate about being on the pastoral staff of a very good church. I mean, you know, it was great. Okay. But God is doing something here in this system that is absolutely something earthquake. Slowly, you know, lifting the plates under the city. You know what it is?
Regenerate.
Well, see, God is not going to let these people drift. Really. We may have forgotten, you know. I mean, some of our churches may have forgotten, you know, that, well, somebody else has been. That's not our market. That's not our niche of ministry. But God has not forgotten these people. Not in the least. And so what happens to people like me who come in to the prison system with an attitude to serve rather than control, and you begin to say, well, where is God at work? What's happening? And your eyes begin to open. Because you realize that the inner city church is deeply engaged with the prison. It's deeply engaged. That's because the families are there. But the history of prison ministry has been, go inside and preach. And if you've got a young guy coming up in a congregation, go, let him learn how to preach. Let's send him to the prison. Yeah. Or you've got a good guitar player, you know, and they let him have some experience in ministry and go to prison. Well, that day is over. That day is past. Prison ministry is no longer about just go inside and preach the gospel. Yes, that's happening, and that's needed, and that's part of it. But what's happening in prison ministry is people are getting serious about the reality that these guys are all coming home. Only a very few don't come home, right? There's a few guys that get put on death row and end up going to sit there for 20 years because they're not executing anybody anymore, except, you know, Governor Mandela just signed an execution warrant Sunday a couple weeks ago. How many years has it been? And yeah, a few guys sit on death row, a few hundred. A few guys die, they get tuberculosis, or they die of AIDS. Some, I was talking to George Fuller, some just die of age. But the vast majority are coming home. And they're connecting. And that's where prison ministry is getting close. Okay? So if you're part of the church that really knows how to mentor somebody and support a family that's going through trauma and crisis, then there's a role.
Are prisoners choosing to be in Bible studies and that kind of thing more because there are no educational programs for adults? Two, who in the city is specifically working with women in prisons? And three, is there a specific thing going on with training guards and ministering to the staff of prisons such that there can be more
humane treatment?
More humane, for the spirit might show up, you're saying.
Yeah. I don't know about the third, but certainly the first two. This material that I've passed out to you there, I'm going to give you some more about the Kingdom Care Reentry Network. There's partners in that network that are working pretty exclusively with women. Because we've segregated the women out now. We've got a brand new prison for the women in the city. And it's a wonderful facility. It has the fastest growing segment of the prison population.
Is that on Street Road as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Riverside Correctional Facility. It's all part of the same campus up there. Think of a university campus. Think of one like Drexel rather than, you know, think of one without nice green trees, you know. But the Philadelphia prisons are basically all in one complex up on State River. There's five prisons that all sit there in that same massive property by the river.
And each of the individual prisons has several thousand people, so the total count is about 9,000 prisoners up there. But they're all in these different buildings, and the women's prison is a separate facility, but it's all part of the complex. I also wanted to quote to you from the Book of Philemon, because in my judgment, that's really, that reflects Paul's philosophy of prison ministry, if you will. He certainly didn't write a textbook on prison ministry, but if you look at his life, and if you listen to his words, you can get a picture of how he understood ministry to people incarcerated and the relationship to those back home. You know the story of Philemon, right? Remember who Philemon was?
Was a slave who seems to...
No, not Philemon.
Philemon was the master. Oh.
Yeah, he wasn't just the master. He was the elder in the church.
Okay.
The church at least at your house. So he was probably the pastor of the church. Okay. Got that? So Paul is writing to this fellow elder. That puts it in a new light for me. You know, when I listen to people in our denomination, the PCA, they have
very high regard for ruling elders and teaching elder. You know, there's a distinction, but they have a great respect for one another, whether one is officially ordained or the other is, you know, a lay leader. We have great confidence in God's sovereign work through the laity in the Presbyterian Church. So whether he's, you know, ordained or a lay elder, Philemon is an elder. I mean, Paul, he's writing to the church that meets in your home. That's in verse 2. But you know the story. There's this guy that, you know, stole or whatever, and he gets in prison, and he meets Paul. Because Paul was there for having preached and created chaos. And so Paul does evangelistic work in this man's life. He comes to faith in Christ. Paul obviously develops a deep emotional relationship with this man, because he calls him my son. Paul also mentors him, because he's mature enough that Paul says, wait a minute, I'd rather keep him here with me because he's so helpful, but I am going to send him home to you because he can be useful to you. So Paul has a picture in his mind that this guy has become a leader capable to be used in the church for ministry. That's not a picture that we typically have about prison. We don't think of prisoners as being potential leaders in the church. We just think, well, the baggage is, I mean, we just have so many stereotypes about prisoners, about people who have been incarcerated for something that they really did. Now, a lot of guys aren't guilty. They're just too poor to pay bail, so they have to sit. And maybe after 2 years, they are exonerated at trial, but they've already been in jail for 2 years. But let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that the majority are actually guilty. Does that mean that they can't be forgiven? Does that mean they can't be welcomed home? Does that mean they can't be used? I don't think so. Because this is what Paul says. Listen to these words. I kind of pulled out some more words. Because, like I said, he calls him my son. He says he was useless, but now he's useful. Because something has happened to this Onesimus. There's some transformation in it, so he's now useful. And that's got to be, that word has to be invested with gospel in it. It's not just that, well, now he can be a better, you know, carpenter, or maybe he can till your fields better. I don't think so. I think it means useful in the kingdom. I believe that. Now, maybe I'm reading it, but I think that's true. He also says, he took your place. Now imagine, he's telling this pastor, this guy, working with me in the prison, who's doing what you would do if you were here. Because he says, that's right there in verse 12. I would have liked to keep him with me so that he could take your place in helping me. That reflects in my mind that this guy is mature enough in the ministry that Paul can trust him to be a pastor. I have to tell you, I've met guys like that in prison. And I trust them to be pastors to other prisoners.
I didn't think it was true before. I went in with sort of typical teacher's attitude, you know, we're going to teach these people. But no, there's some guys in there that ran drug operations I could never figure out in my whole life. You know, employed, you know, a couple dozen people on the street, making $40,000 a month. And you get that guy studying the Bible, and then he gets a job as a chaplain's aide so he can be in the church every day as his prison job. You don't think God can use that guy as a pastor inside? It's exciting to me. Truly exciting. The last three chaplain aides that we've had in the prison where I go have been powerful men of faith. They've had to stand up to unbelievable stuff to have their faith tested. And God has used them to walk them. And in some ways, I kind of stand back and kind of let them, you know, almost every week, this one guy, Thomas, he gives an impromptu sermon. You know, I said to the guys last week, I said, I wish we, you know, you're not allowed to record it because of me. I take this little player in there just so I can take a choir with them. But they do allow me to play CDs. But I said to everybody, I said, it's too bad we can't record, you know, his little sermon. That's every week. But they're punishable. I mean, they're. But why is it that we? Because we have stereotypes. We have an image, and they have an image. They have an image in their minds that nobody wants them. An image like, well, nobody will hire me because, you know, I'm an ex-offender, which is also a myth. But thinking about the church, people don't want me back in the church because I have to spin them. They're not going to allow me to, you know, be a leader. Well, I think we won't get the kind of growth if we don't open up leadership. I mean, when guys are in Sunday school, it's a little joke, man. Somebody comes along and says, you know, someday you make a good preacher. And that kid never forgets that. Or some grandmother, you know, says, oh, you know, such a wonderful prayer. Well, you're going to really just, God is going to use you so. And so that those images, you know, become part of who that little child becomes. Bishop Granville here around here. He's been preaching since he was 12. And it was because some guy came along and gave him an opportunity to teach the children, preach to the children at 12 years of age, and just nurture them and encourage them. Well, for these inmates, that hasn't been their history. But it doesn't mean that God doesn't have the capacity in them. They don't have the skills and the tools. So I'm spending a lot of time talking about that, urging you to think differently. Because I think that's what's most important about prison. I don't think it's program, even though, you know, we have materials. I don't think it's organizational structure. I think it has everything to do with the fact that God is touching, by his Spirit, a new generation of leaders, and we have to have eyes that can see that. And we have to be able to welcome them, empower them, and provide place for them in the city to serve and to lead. Now let me get back to my outline because somebody help me with the time here.
2:15.
What?
You asked for the time, I gave you 2:15.
2:30. It says on my chart. 2:30. All right.
I'm talking so much, I didn't even. When you came in here, I was playing South African gospel choir. I don't know if you listened to it. Part of it was in Zulu, part in English. The Lord will make a way for me. Every week I like to play music as a kind of coming out. I mean, we don't have like an organ. So if you let me take that deep in there. But music is so important. And I take the choir because choir music is powerful. But choir music is hard to hear the lyrics. So I write the lyrics for them every week. And a navigator's a big on Bible memory. I mentioned that. If you've ever been with a navigator Bible study, you can go to verse cards. There's a whole topical memory system with the navigators. You learn all the doctrines of the Bible through memory verses. Well, in this Bible study, the stuff I just showed you, for each of the Bible studies, there's a recommended memory verse. And there's a page where the verses are printed out There's 10 copies of it printed. So at Staples, you can buy a business card page and print them out as business cards. So you don't have to go buy all the topical printed from Navigators in bulk. You just print that yourself. And you buy the cheaper ones, you know, the Staples brand. Okay? So that's what I do. I print them out. I run, you know, 10 on a sheet. I tear them up and pass them out to the guys every week. But what I do on the back of those cards is I put the lyrics to the song. That's what you have on the back of the sheet. Our memory verse for yesterday was James 1 book. No, excuse me, this is Saturday, Wednesday. Sorry, wrong word. We memorized James 1:12, and then the song for the day was Open Tabernacle Choir. The reason I like to use the South African music is because I visited there, but it's a lot more than that. God has lifted up that country in a remarkable way. They've been through trauma as a nation, and they've been through reconciliation. There's a process of reconciliation in which God has kind of lifted that up to the whole world to see. And my partner, who's in with me this week, is a South African pastor. It's amazing how God puts together. I hired a South African in Philadelphia to work with me at the Leadership Foundation. And she and her husband had great experience in prison, and they taught us a lot about working with prisoners. And she introduced me to this guy locally here. He had come here 7 years ago. God called him to Philadelphia. He did not like this country. He did not want to come to America. All the reasons, you know, all the crass mercantilism in this society. But God dragged him over here, you know, through a church connection to serve in Philadelphia. But he's a man of great faith. Absolutely wonderful faith. He trusted God's call in his life. He came here, and God gave him home. God gave him a car. He's got all kinds of stories of how God met his needs, you know. So this old Presbyterian is hooked up to this Pentecostal Black South African preacher. And we're in here every week. So the South African music is fun because, you know, we kind of joke around about it, but he knows the words. But the reason the music is so important is it touches some chord inside in a way that all of our great hymns. All of it. And especially for somebody that wrestles with, you know, written language, you would be amazed at how much these guys know about South Africa. They know the history of King Shaka and the Zulus, and they know all about what happened to Nelson Mandela. And when I use an illustration with them about reconciliation, they have a picture in their mind. You know, Desmond Tutu wrote that book about his own experience, entitled it, "There Was No Future Without Forgiveness." I don't know if you've ever seen that book. It's his story of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Well, there's an African-American pastor scholar who worked with Desmond at Emory University.
When Tutu came here for cancer treatment, he was did a stint on the adjunct faculty at Emory University School of Theology. And he was here for extended treatment for his prostate cancer. Well, this guy worked with Tutu. He's a Church of God in Christ pastor, Robert Franklin. He was just appointed as the new president of Morehouse College this past fall. Franklin has an absolutely wonderful, wonderful message to the church based on scripture, but also the emotional experience of connecting with Desmond Tutu. He has a powerful, powerful picture that the church needs to welcome home these men and women who have been broken. Reconciliation needs to happen, but there's no future for them without that reconciliation. They come back home without that. Their options are so limited. They're back on the street. The recidivism patterns, you know, are repeated. The answer, in my judgment, to this big question of recidivism is really the role of the church. To give people an opportunity at home. So on that sheet that I handed out to you, I wrote this little vision statement I gave you this statement from the Philadelphia prisons, and the reason is because of that one sentence about preparing people for the entry. When you walk into prison, any of the buildings of the prison, you see the mission statement. Now, good corporate practice. Every business is supposed to have a mission statement, I think. Well, they do, and they have it up there. But I think the Philadelphia prisons care about that. Now, it's a huge institution. It's our turn to Queen Mary. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. But when Mayor Street issued a call to the criminal justice system to face the recidivism failure and do something about it, he also issued a call to the church. That's why that faith-based task force got connected to the prisons. Because he asked the churches to create some kind of process where any inmate coming home from prison would at least have the opportunity to connect to a local congregation. And figure that out. Well, it seemed that's kind of easy. I mean, we could do a workshop this afternoon, put up a chart, and, you know, write it all up. To actually make that happen, that was 8 years ago. It's beginning now to happen. It takes time. First of all, it took time for the system to recognize what it needed to do. I was part of a group called the Philadelphia Consensus Group for Reintegration, Reentry and Reintegration of Ex-Offenders. They pulled together district attorney, commissioner of prisons, and police commissioner, the Defender Association, different people from nonprofits. We spent 2 years producing this little thin little document. But the purpose of it was to identify the kind of obstacles that people have to come home from prison. Why is it so difficult to get back, to reintegrate? I mean, everybody's reentering, but not everybody successfully reintegrates. Well, some people lose their license, and so they have no ID. Some people have child support payments that kept on going, so when they come home, they got a $25,000 bill that they can't possibly pay. There's all kinds of things that happen. And I think we got identified 60 or 65 distinct different kind of obstacles that a person might face from the country. And what did the system and the community need to do to help bridge those? Well, the church is part of it. And I was in that thing representing the churches in the city. And the system recognized they were making it impossible for churches. Because for years and years, there's been something called a fraternizing rule.
What?
A fraternizing rule. So if you went inside to do Bible study like I was talking about every week, you're on the list, you're an approved person, and you got your ID, you know. The reason I put this on here is so that you would see I'm really with Impacting Your World Christian Center in Germantown. Okay. My partner, Jeffy, is my supervisor now. To me, that's wonderful. You know, I drafted him, but he's now my supervisor. Big black church in Germany. But the reality is, when we sat and looked at this with officials from the prison system, that's one of the keys to it, was the commissioner and the deputy commissioners were in this process. And we were talking about, all right, you know, how do you mentor somebody? And they began to talk about the process of how somebody gets, they finish their term and they get released from jail, et cetera, et cetera. And they realized, wait a minute. We haven't been allowing these people to connect. Because if you come inside, where you get to know the prisoners, the fraternizing rule said they can't contact you on the outside. You can't contact them on the outside. And I know they did it for a good reason. I know they were concerned about security. They didn't want little old ladies coming into prison and being, you know, taken advantage of by these, you know, guys. But the reality is you couldn't possibly mentor somebody. Okay. I mean, if I lead somebody to Christ in prison, and I'm seeing that guy every week in some way, it means I can't hire him to renovate my father-in-law's house, which I just did last Saturday. I just signed a contract with a guy who used to be our chaplain's aide. He's an excellent contractor. And he's a good job crew. He's got a whole crew of guys in there. They're all speaking Spanish. they're renovating the house. Of course, he was in a nursing home, the family has to sell the house. So I turned the key of the house over there. Well, under the old system, that would have been possible. But what, so what happened through this process was the prison began to change the rules and make it possible now for the churches. So the commissioner comes to the first public forum that we had of our network. You have a couple newspaper articles that talk about this Kingdom Care Reentry Network. We've had a series of public forums and some trainings for people. There's more copies coming. When the Commissioner of Prisons came and spoke at our public reentry forum, he gave a whole list of things that the churches could do. And the top of the list was to become mentors to our men and women and help them come home. That is an absolutely brand new day in Philadelphia. To have the system asking the church to participate as face-to-face mentors with them. And our organization now has a contract with the mayor's office. We're the official mentor partner for the mayor's office of reentry. We have written memorandum of agreement with prison and with the probation parole department to be part of an early release mentor partnership with them. That never would happen. But the deputy commissioner and Al McHale had looked at that problem and said, well, we have to change. He was not a believer. He's an atheistic,
secular Jew. I don't want to call him an atheist.
He's not a believer. He's very clear about that. He has very high respect for the churches that really do this work, that are serious about it. But it was Alan Appel that God used to see that problem and solve it on the inside. At the same time that that process was going on in the system, on the outside in the church, this group is forming, this Kingdom Care Reentry Network. Bishop McNear, who's the chairman, is an ex-offender himself. His church had for 10 years at least had an aftercare ministry. So he knew the issues, he was involved in it, he knew what was needed, and he agreed to be the chairman of this new network. So if you can kind of think of it this way, God was creating a kind of a plug on the wall with a certain configuration, and out in the church, he was configuring, you know, a plug to fit into that socket. All right? If you ever travel overseas, you know you got to take your own plugs because you've got electricity that doesn't work right. Well, God was adjusting the socket and the plug to fit. And now what's going on is that people are flowing through that. Inmates, you know, and volunteers are connecting them in a way that was impossible in the past. So that part of what gets me excited is because, see, God is sovereign over the judge, he's sovereign over the commissioner, he's sovereign over the mayor, just like he's sovereign over the board of elders. There's really no distinction, right? Anybody reformed enough to believe that? You've got, you know, sermons on Romans. So think of it in practical terms. God is really at work. That's what excites me. This is not my work. It's not my project. It's not, you know, some navigator strategy. God is stirring the pot in our prison system. And the opportunity is huge,
absolutely huge. So that little vision statement I wrote,
my dream and my hope is that every church that goes inside a prison to do Bible study will also be doing it. Now, I think that someday, maybe not too far in the future, the system is going to require it. Because I remember sitting with the Deputy Commissioner in Buckley, the co-chair of the workshop I did, we did some of the prison. We did one on faith-based community. And we talked about it. The possible reality will become a requirement. You want to bring your band, your choir, as well come in there, sing and dance and preach. And also have to open the door to people that live in that house. And I think it'll happen. And the dream is right in it. I believe God is raising a whole new generation of the church. It's a piece you were a missionary in a
different country, I don't want to say foreign country, in a different country,
your strategy would be to establish a beachhead for the gospel to have people with it, right? And then to train and empower a group of national leaders to move the gospel into the society. And why wouldn't you do that here? It's because you already have the picture that, well, prisoners are already this marginalized group over here. It doesn't matter. If you're going to reach the city, you've got to come here. That's the way the gospel works. The gospel always makes its deepest roots among the people most marginalized by the culture. I know that PCA has specific ministries that are different. People in Hollywood, people in Washington. You know, the history of the church has always been. The gospel spreads in the city. It goes to the really does. So I'm telling you that I think that God is igniting a wildfire of revival and renewal in heaven that's not coming out of our church plants. As good as that is, what he said, that we're doing. It is exploding underneath. So the subways is coming in inner city neighborhoods that look like they're bombed out. Because these guys are coming back home, the former drug dealer is now sharing Jesus with you. So I hope that you can feel some of the enthusiasm I do. Because the final question I have at the bottom here is, I believe that future is already here. And if your church is involved in prison ministry, then you need to get involved in ministry. That's the real reason. That's where you can work with family, children, you can nurture somebody in the cycle, you can help get a child. Even the prospect that you're going to do with them to help them with their job is an enormous hub. You'd be amazed when you pass out these brochures to God. It's not, hey, suck them up right there. Out somebody too. What happens to know that somebody cares enough to at least promise it. And then our job is to follow through and make sure that we're really there. We answer the phone. So I'm hoping that by all this rambling discussion that I've given you, you get a different picture of prison ministry. It's really relational work where people come out of pain more than it is going behind those walls to do some kind of special kind of thing. Because listen, they are all coming home anyway. And the guy who is a taxi driver, you know, or the guy that's selling newspapers at the corner, you're related to these folks all the time. You just don't know that they happen to have been incarcerated 6 months ago. So let's get, you know, proactive about that. And begin to identify who, you know, who wants this help from the church. If an inmate says yes to that question, you know you have solved the constitutional problem of church and state. No, I'm serious.
This is my last point. As a part of that consensus group, I served on a subcommittee that was pulled together by the DA and the probation parole and the defender system
to actually write a release plan for the prison. Where they would, the Defender Association, they love to get guys out of jail. They like to identify people early that they think are going to be a good candidate for early release. So they write an order to the judge, and if the judge says okay, that guy gets out early. And if he's got good behavior inside, it's a good deal. Well, what they wanted to do was put together an organized plan that would become a model for the whole prison system. And I served on this committee. Well, my contribution to the committee was to say, look, you can take a look at the educational background, the medical history, social workers to do this, you know, what about the spiritual experience? How are we going to connect these folks to the church? And they said, well, we thought your groups would do that. So, all right, well, I wrote a spiritual section for this reentry evaluation plan, which they modified and adopted, but the heart of it was the question, would you like to have a mentor from a faith-based community? And if the person says yes, they check off yes. Then the boy is downtown, they've all signed off on it, say they have a task of must have because they volunteered. They had a choice to go with this group, and they chose to go to this group. So as a faith-based Christian group, we can connect with them without fear of being sued or whatever. So I mean, all of that to me is evidence piling up that God is opening huge door of opportunity, a huge door. So I would just encourage you to think and pray about your own situation, your own church situation. If you're interested at all, you've got the phone number for our Kingdom Care, the Mentor Network. We're going to do another public forum this year and another mentor training. We've trained about 150 mentors. We've now served about 300 inmates coming home. This group is just really starting to roll. So I just invite you to be part of it and see what God will do in your situation and how God will bless you. Because I know my family has been absolutely blessed by getting my David. He's been up on the roof. right? I mean, it's like a mess in this country. Lord, thank you for your grace in restoring us relationship to you. And as we came home to the gospel, we came home to the kingdom, you welcomed us with open arms. And we pray you help us to help others in the church think with open minds and open hearts about the restoration of men and women in the incarcerated. And we pray for your blessing.